Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of December 26th, 2014. I'm going to recommend that you listen to today's show with a cup of hot chocolate, or maybe a glass of wine, or I don't know, how about a bowl of guacamole? Basically, whatever you like to indulge in. Maybe you even want to sit in a bubble bath and listen. Because today, we are indulging. Or even overindulging on occasion, which is pretty standard this time of year. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week's show, you guessed it, is about indulgence, what we allow ourselves, what we don't, and our sometimes complex relationship with course correcting after indulgence. As always, we want to hear from you. Tell us about the indulgences you can't live without on our website, Marketplace Weekend, on the Marketplace Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Me, by the way, I'm the guacamole person. I will never give up avocados. We're going to start off our show today with a story about whether government regulations can change our indulgent behavior. So we went out to get a snack in New York City. Here in New York, looking at a menu and choosing whether you want to indulge in something has become a little different over the past few years. That's because menus at chain restaurants like this Le Pain Quotidien and movie theaters and lots of other places now include calorie counts. Whatever you order has a number attached to it. This avocado, yeah, that's 540. Or wow, basil chicken and mozzarella, 710. Wow. Well, now I'm feeling, you know, kind of guilty because I can see what their calorie count is. The Food and Drug Administration recently wrote calorie count recommendations for restaurants around the country, setting off a debate about what the health effects will be. The research is a little murky about how much the counts change behavior. For example, I was admittedly not deterred by the higher number.
Can I have a small latte?
Yes.
Which is what, 30? Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Well, it depends on the milk.
Depends on the milk. Okay, I want the full-fat milk.
Good. So a small latte, full-fat milk.
And you know what? Why not? I will also have a brioche clocking in at 470 calories. That is on the heavier end of the scale here.
The FDA regulations do something pretty standard in economics, a cost-benefit analysis. The government uses existing studies to estimate the bottom line impact of calorie counts on public health, on businesses having to change their menus, and so on. But tucked into the 125,741 words about calorie count guidelines, the FDA put something pretty remarkable. A little clause about quote-unquote lost pleasure. The government estimates that Americans will lose up to $5.27 billion in pleasure over 20 years. Because, you know, it could be a bummer to choose apples over donuts, salads over fries. You get the idea.
I'll have the most boring thing possible, a pot of Earl Grey, please.
Earl Grey? Do you drink milk with that?
Yes, please. Skim milk would be great.
That was so virtuous.
Well,
that's Sharon Begley ordering her drink. She's a senior health correspondent for Reuters, and this lost pleasure calculation caught her eye. I began by asking Begley how the government starts figuring all this stuff out.
The FDA has, you can imagine, this gigantic ledger with the cost of the regulation on one side and the medical and health benefits on the other. As you can tell, it's not an exact science. But we sort of know what a heart attack costs in terms of, you know, medical treatment. We sort of know loss of life, and you can put a dollar value on that.
And that wonderful dollar figure for lost pleasure?
So this is where the controversy kicked up. And it was like they took a baseball bat to a hornet's nest, because public health groups, economists, you know, the gamut, are just furious about this. And what it did was figure out that when that person, that hypothetical customer we're talking about, is deterred from the high-calorie brownie and instead orders an apple, hypothetically, that person is really unhappy. That person is, you know, just salivating over the thought of that brownie he could have had and looking at this, you know, horrible little apple in his hands and just really, really resenting the government and everybody else, undoubtedly. So FDA tried to put a dollar figure on that lost pleasure. In the regulation that was issued in November, FDA discounted the projected health benefits of its of the menu counts, the calorie counts on menus, by between $2 and $5.3 billion. It almost zeroed out the benefits.
And I guess, you know, it almost makes explicit this concept that is implicit in these calorie counts, which is you're not getting something.
Mainstream economists from, you know, pick your university say this was is not the right way to go about it. But FDA says, no, we really think that this is legitimate. But then you ask, okay, well, then what dollar figure did you put on how virtuous that Apple orderer feels? So really, you can just play this out forever. And the reason public health groups are so concerned about this is that FDA looks like it might be applying this kind of analysis, lost pleasure, to many, many regulations. They did so with the tobacco regulations that they issued earlier this year. When smokers are deterred from smoking as much, how much do they miss it? How much enjoyment have they lost? Let's put a dollar figure on that. Would you want to do that for illegal drugs? Gee, we're making it harder for people to buy from their favorite meth dealer. Are we going to put a dollar on their lost enjoyment? How about the lost enjoyment that 15-year-olds suffer because we don't let them drive? I mean, really, you can play this out indefinitely.
So this thing that in some ways seems almost whimsical or amusing has a real flip side and potentially could change the way this regulation is applied.
Industry obviously looks at that, and if the cost is awfully close to the benefit, that gives industry a much firmer footing to challenge the regulation in court.
Wow. I'm going to taste my whole milk latte.
And I'm going to taste my virtuous Earl Grey tea.
What is the pleasure differential between my latte and your tea?
See, you've put your finger on a crucial point that the economists make. They argue that if, as just happened, you and I have chosen freely, then by definition, we chose what would make us happiest. Now, if you had asked, well, what if FDA decides to ban pizza? Banning something absolutely would deprive people of enjoyment, and then the FDA would clearly be on much firmer economic ground. But remember, they're not banning brownies and hot chocolate. They're just giving people information about them.
You've covered health and science for a long time. Does the idea of putting a dollar figure on not items, but behaviors and emotions almost, did that surprise you?
You know, economists are a wacky bunch. They have never met an item or behavior that they have not wanted to stick a dollar sign in front of. Whether this succeeds remains to be seen. Again, because this particular FDA analysis was based on an unpublished paper by a graduate student.
By a grad student.
Yeah. So it has not quite a firm foundation in published research, which economists I spoke to kept pointing out to me. So we'll see if it stands.
Sharon Begley, Senior Health and Science Correspondent for Reuters, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of Marketplace Weekend. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and that couldn't have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate to Marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. Thank you so much for your support. We love to collect people's stories about money and where their lives collide with the economy. Maybe you indulge by spending a night at a comedy club. Now we've got a story about life up on that stage and all the work that goes into getting there.
Oh, hello! I'm Cameron Esposito, and I'm a stand-up comic. I've been making jokes my whole life to distract people from my wildly crossed eyes and my intense gayness, but stand-up is unusual in that it is a profession, eventually. This is my job now. This is what I do for a living, and I apply it in a bunch of different ways. I make videos, or I'm on television, or I write, but the basis is all my stand-up career. And, you know, you really don't get paid to do your job for many years. You know, you go out every night of the week and you hit an open mic. Open mics, it turns out, do not pay because it is an open microphone and you're telling all your terrible jokes because you're like 1 week into stand-up. So all comics have other jobs that they do. I worked in schools for a while. I was a tutor. I was also a circus ringmaster. That was another thing that I did. I ran a video game booth at a concert, like a first-person shooter video game that was in the back of this concert. You know, putting a gun in anybody's hands is not my favorite thing to do. I also was hired by a beverage company that was debuting a new soda, and the way they were going to do this was they made these talking vending machines. So it's a vending machine with a camera in it, and then you're off-site and you're looking through the camera and you're talking through a microphone to who's ever in front of the vending machine. It's supposed to be like a really hilarious thing, like, oh, hey, I'm in a vending machine. I'm a person. Come grab a soda. But we set it up outside of Wrigley Field. And Wrigley Field is where the Cubs play in Chicago, and there are very avid and very raucous fans that go see Cubs games. So the first person that walked past that particular time, I said, like, hey, guy, you know, come on over here, get a soda. And that person and his friends pushed over the vending machine and then peed on it. I would be lying to you if I didn't say that there is a cool part to all of this stuff. It's like backpacking across the country or across Europe, but from your own house. You know, like there's a lot to explore in instability. Actually, that's still what it's like being a comic today, because now I do this for a living and I do get paid for it. Creating your own financial stability when there's nobody else helping you with that is a great way to learn how to create career stability in a career that has no inherent stability. You know, I have two podcasts. I write a column for the AV Club. I tour and I'm working on a book and I'm putting together like television proposals and I go on voiceover auditions, and that is this job. You know, sometimes people think it's that the job is just going and doing club work, but that's not this job. This job is the same thing that I was doing then. And I do think that having this skill to figure out like the different ways to tweak something really prepared me to move to LA and to try and be viable here.
Cameron Esposito's latest stand-up comedy album is called Same Sex Symbol. Now to digital indulgence.
Today we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
Do you have any hobbies?
I collect spores, molds, and fungus.
This is tech in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
You look guilty.
More than normal.
Yeah, more than normal. What are we talking about today? Do you look so guilty?
We're going to talk about digital hoarding.
What does that look like? Because I think I'm getting a hint from your facial expression, which listeners
like
can't
me.
See, but you look kind of ashamed.
It looks like me. I'm not the worst, but I'm going to show you. I've got my Gmail box pulled up here. This is my number of unread.
Oh my! You haven't read any of those?
No.
What is wrong with you?
I have 10,218 unread emails in my Gmail.
They're multiple Google Calendar appointments. There.
Yes.
You've got a bank. That's not even a real bank thing. That's a credit card offer.
Yeah, it's bad. It's just a problem. It's a problem.
I'm embarrassed for you.
I know. I'm embarrassed for myself. I will say that, like, generally speaking, there are other examples of this, right? There's mm-hmm. the having a ton of photos on your phone that you never actually do anything with.
Okay,
you
I have
don't
a lot of dog
them.
Pictures. That's fair.
Okay. See, here we go. Maybe you've got a few skeletons in your phone closet, as it were. And then there's, of course, you know, the entire catalog of Jethro Tull live performances in your iTunes, for instance. That's not me.
Oh, Ben.
I'm just saying, no, that's not me. I don't like a man playing flute as the lead. I just, you know, bad file management.
Well, you're a musician. Maybe you hang on to stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I like to hang on to things. And other people, too, like to do this. And it's a growing problem. This is because our stuff lives online now, or at least on our devices. And a lot of this stuff is in the cloud. The storage is free because our data and ourselves have become the product, as the saying goes, right? So actually, Google probably doesn't mind too much if it's got 10,000 of my emails sitting around to mine for information that might be useful to it, et cetera, et cetera. However you feel about this, though, the reality is this stuff has kind of become invisible.
It's invisible and it isn't, though, right? Because, I mean, sure, you maybe aren't seeing piles of paper around you everywhere, right, but this is taking up space in your hard drive.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I
Does your computer groan under the weight of all of this?
Sometimes.
We're going to adopt a little Lizzie style here. Be ruthless.
Yes.
If you were ruthless.
Yes.
How would you manage this?
Okay, so I think there are a couple basic rules, right? Be willing to delete. Try it. It feels good, right? It feels good to delete. Chances are, if you think about it for half a second, right, you know in your heart of hearts, it's not important. So get rid of it. Another thing is good file management. That's something outside of email I'm relatively good at. On my desktop computer, you won't see that much. And that helps you gain access to things that you are keeping. And I think that that's really important. Also, build habits around the content you're creating. If you create photos all the time by taking pictures, know what you're going to do with that photo and build a habit around doing it immediately instead of just snapping the photo, putting it back in your pocket or whatever.
So all photos for Barney the dog go into a file labeled as such, the end.
Or they get deleted. Or maybe you, every time you take a photo of Barney the dog, you have to delete a photo of Barney the dog. Build however you want to create these habits. But you can also automate these habits, which I think is really interesting. There's this cool website called IFTTT, If This Then That. For instance, I've set up a program that will take all of the photos that I post to Instagram and send them to my Dropbox. And that way I can save all of the photos that I post to Instagram in a way that's simple and it goes into a specific folder for these photos, et cetera, et cetera. I also have one that sends all of the tweets that I favorite to a Google Drive spreadsheet. So I can go back if I want to read stuff.
Sometimes if you're using favorites as a bookmark or something like
that. Okay. I can do that. But again, always be willing to delete, right? Just like real life clutter, this stuff weighs you down emotionally, I think.
Ben Johnson, before I let you go.
Yes.
I want you to do this in front of me.
Oh, no. What do you want me to do?
That one. Delete that one. Just one so I can tell
this
that you.
This one right
yeah,
here?
That one.
Okay.
That
I'm
is a credit
it.
Card offer. You don't need that.
Yeah, that's true.
Boom, gone.
Oh, God. I felt
How'd
good.
How'd that feel?
That felt good.
Yeah.
I like it. I'm going to do a couple more.
Okay, good. Yeah, you keep clicking. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
You can get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app at the iTunes Store or on Google Play. I want to move now from our tech segment to a story about a traditional industry affected by tech. Chances are, if you need to tell time this instant, you could look at a smartphone, maybe a computer, and if you're more of a traditionalist, a wristwatch. The watch industry is in the middle of an overhaul as wearables and smartwatches become more common. You might think that would hurt sales, but there's an interesting surge at the more indulgent end of the watch spectrum. Demand for high-end watches, particularly for women, was up more than 20% this year. To help us dig a little deeper, we asked Karen Guyberson to come on the show. She is the president of the Accessories Council. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you very much.
When you look at the explosion in wearable watches, I mean, I'm thinking about the Apple Watch here. It's going to retail for some $350. Why spend money on a watch that is a traditional watch and tells time versus something that's like a little mini computer you can wear on your wrist?
Well, I think there's always going to be people who love technology and love to play with gadgets. And ultimately, if the Apple Watch has features and benefits that are going to make my life easier, I'm going to want to add it on and incorporate it. I wear a Fitband from time to time because...
Oh, yeah, you're wearing it now.
Yeah, it helps me be aware of how many steps I'm taking. And, you know, if I need to get in a few more blocks to hit my goal for the day, I'm going to do that. So if a smartwatch adds to my life and makes it easier and better, then I may be inclined to wear something like that. But I suspect it will be part of one's watch wardrobe, that they may have a fine timepiece or watches that they wear for career purposes or something more special that they might wear for going out, and that might have another function or another application as part of a wardrobe of watches that one might own.
I'm thinking about how the industry shifts and changes with the introduction of different kinds of technology. What are the biggest changes you've seen among other watchmakers to respond to the surge in wearables?
Anyone who's making particularly fashion watches has to pay attention to technology and keeping themselves relevant and keeping their watches fun. But I think that technology has started to get better looking, which makes it more fun. And if you think about, you know, those clunky old watches that, you know, used to have keypads and you can play games and things. They were fun, but they really weren't very pretty. Now they are more stylish. And I think that for women particularly, it's really important that the product looks good and it fits in with their wardrobe and it fits in with their fashion. And that even if it's cool, if it doesn't look good, they're probably not going to wear it.
As wearables start to incorporate some of these functions, date, different time zones, all those other things, do you think we're going to see more traditional watches add more features to kind of play at that level?
Perhaps calling what Apple's doing a watch is limiting. It's really wrist technology. Some of this is much, much more than a watch. Depending on how easy it is to use, it's got a different function than a beautiful Mabata watch. So I think of it more as technology that you happen to wear on your wrist than a traditional watch.
I'm also interested in designers who seem to be capitalizing on this moment where women in particular are interested in something that's got some tech to it, but that looks really good.
Absolutely. I think that some of those designers, you know, if you look at someone like Betsy Johnson, who makes watches that are fun and bold and whimsical and colorful and bright, they look very much like her clothes look like. Tory's lovely. You would want to wear them every day. There's a sense of style to those watches. There's a brand Invicta that has a very distinct style. Again, it's about fashion. It's about of the moment. It's about tying it in. And for those people who are fans of the brand, it's another way to incorporate their favorite brands into their wardrobe.
Karen Guyberson is president of the Accessories Council. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Focusing on indulgence this week, which can sometimes generate economic growth. If you think about it on a macro level, spending can bring growth. There's a problem in Europe right now, though. The one country that's been pulling along the rest of the continent, Germany, is pretty spending averse, and that is generating resentment both in the rest of cash-strapped Europe and even at home. The BBC's Paul Moss has this story from Leipzig.
It's a manufacturing company at the top of its game. At the Goldschmidt factory, just outside Leipzig, they make railway equipment, mainly high-spec track for high-speed trains. Goldschmidt products are sought after across the world, but right now, the company's not selling as much as it would like. Cash-strapped countries in Europe just aren't building much in the way of new railway lines. But what really seems to annoy the CEO here, Hans-Jürgen Mündinger, is that he can't even sell new track to his own country, because Germany won't spend what's needed, he says, to get its railway systems up to scratch.
The German railway was the railway where all the other countries came to see the first-class railway. And this has changed totally. The investments in new high-speed lines have been too little. And the current plans for spending on railway infrastructure in Germany are by far not enough for the future.
It's a complaint you'll come across again and again here, and not just about the railways. Many of Germany's roads, its bridges, even its schools are looking distinctly tatty. Meanwhile, German economic growth is slowing. The lower demand for its goods, both at home and abroad, has taken a toll. There have been calls for the government here to get the economy moving again by throwing some cash at all that infrastructure, which does need improving. But the German government has a constitutional requirement to keep borrowing down. It's now committed to having a zero budget deficit next year. So don't expect Germany to splurge on infrastructure spending anytime soon, much as some would like it.
The government should invest more into the public infrastructure. This could be partly done by borrowing, but the Germans are a bit obsessed with the budget deficit.
Wilhelm Ultemer is professor of economics at the Leipzig School of Management. He believes Germany's pursuit of a balanced budget is for political reasons and national prestige, rather than for any rational economic reason.
I think that the German government wants to serve as a role model. They want to show the other European countries what is possible to balance your budget. It is a symbol, it is a myth. There are times when it is good to have debts, to borrow money and to invest it into the infrastructure.
In one of Leipzig's main squares, I got some idea just how much it goes against the grain for Germany to get into debt. They were holding a Christmas market, though with none of your usual Yuletide tat. The children's toys on sale were elegantly carved handicrafts. Even the Santas were cute rather than kitsch. But then I tried suggesting to shoppers that these gifts were so nice, they might consider borrowing a bit of money to buy them.
No, I don't think so. My identity is that I don't like borrow money. I think it's a question of security and mentality. We are careful people.
Germans?
Yes, it's German culture.
Can I ask you, would you borrow money to buy anything?
No, I don't. I take what I have to buy presents and choose what I can afford.
You don't ever feel tempted? I mean, look at all these beautiful gifts around us.
No.
Do you use your credit card ever at Christmas and buy things that maybe are beyond your limit?
I cannot use my credit card because I have no one.
You don't have a credit card?
I have never had one, and I think I will never have one. My father came home after the Second World War. This was a very hard time. My parents can only pay what they have. That was a part of my education.
In fact, this cautious attitude to debt is causing some present-day international tensions, because other members of the European Union are now telling Germany to stop being such a fiscal skinflint. EU member states want the German government to spend some dosh and to encourage German consumers to get out their wallets and purses. For the last couple of years, it's only German growth that's kept the Eurozone out of recession. And according to Christian Erdendahl from the think tank, the Centre for European Reform, if even Germans stop buying things, the rest of the continent will feel the effects.
German demand is important for the Eurozone because other countries in the Eurozone are struggling. Germany at the moment is not spending enough to compensate for the weakness in the rest of the Eurozone. You need some country to spend, and Germany is best placed because of low levels of debt. German unemployment is at record lows. Without German demand, it will be very, very hard for the Eurozone to grow out of its mess.
It was the annual Christmas dinner for Germany's ruling political party, and the Leipzig Christian Democrats seem to be proving what a frugal bunch they are. Just sausage and mash on the menu, rather than anything more seasonal or fancy. And when I spoke to the party's Leipzig chairman, Robert Clemen politely suggested that the EU can say what it likes, Germany will pursue its own economic goals. Thank you very much.
I think Germany has done a lot for the European Union in the last 10, 15 years. We listen to the European Union, but we like to have a balance between what we do for the European Union and what we get from it.
But what some commentators are saying is it would be good for Germany as well if you stop this goal of having a zero budget deficit and spend the money on yourselves, on your infrastructure.
I think it's not a good idea. There's always people, they're telling you to spend a lot of money, and you need some guys telling you to spend not so lot of money.
You certainly can't accuse Germans of being totally bar humbug about Christmas. The centre of Leipzig is completely covered in seasonal decorations right now, and it feels like there are carols on just about every street corner. But Christmas 2014 is clearly not going to be a time of mass overconsumption here, nor will there be much of that in the year to come. European calls for Germany to spend, spend, spend seem to be falling on deaf ears. Santa Claus and his reindeer are welcome here, but no one either hopes or expects him to hand out expensive gifts that are enjoyed today but have to be paid for tomorrow.
That story comes to us from our partners at the BBC. We're talking about indulgence this week. So, what do you indulge in this time of year? Or try not to indulge in. We're going to talk to a financial planner in a second. But first, here are a few of your stories.
What do I indulge in?
Coffee.
Expensive coffee,
I would say.
Straight whiskey.
Only sometimes I'm using drink.
Movies, personal time with the family, and sleep.
What's my, like, dirty little secret? Massages. Pretty much one of my favorite things.
Ooh, I plead the fifth on that one.
Work.
Yeah, I don't really keep myself from too much. I go to the gym, so, you know, try to keep it balanced.
Try to not do?
I make my coffee at home.
Yeah, it's pretty much the sweets, the sugar. Yeah, stay away from that.
I sold my motorcycle.
I usually try not to buy myself anything, just so I can see if someone gets it for me.
Drinking? I don't drink much, so I kind of cut that out.
We don't drink wine.
I do stay away from the booze. Because nobody wants to be that guy at the dinner party.
Like, I paid $5 for an Intelligentsia latte, which is not something I do during the rest of the year.
To talk about indulgences and also the ones we might try to cut out, I'm joined by Louis Barajas. He's a certified financial planner and friend of the show. Hi, Louis.
Hi, Lizzie. Happy holidays and Feliz Navidad.
Thank you very much. And to you as well.
Thank you.
So we heard all these voices of people who either try to cut things out or they indulge during the holiday season. What do people tend to splurge on, do you think, during the holiday season in your experience?
Well, it was funny listening to the people. It seemed like they just indulge in either caffeine or alcohol, right? I found that interesting. You know, it used to be, do you remember a long time ago, maybe you might remember people indulged in bikes and slip and slides for their kids. It's now technology and jewelry during this time of the year. And technology, even though the prices have come down, it's still expensive. You know, you're going to buy your kid an iPad or a phone, it becomes expensive. So that's what I think I see mostly people indulging in.
You have been doing this work for a long time. I'm wondering, what are the worst financial indulgences you've seen?
I actually had a lady who set a spending limit of $2,000 for Christmas and ended up spending, I think it was $15,000 on one of those Disney spending holiday vacation packages for her family. So things that you didn't expect because you got caught up with the emotion.
You know, I think about what messages were given, particularly by advertisements during the holiday season. And if I just had to go by TV alone, I feel like I am being told to buy diamonds, chocolate, and a car with a giant bow on the roof. Why is it, do you think, that Americans are so conditioned to kind of let it go a little bit and just give in at this time of year?
There are a couple things, right? I think it's behavioral. One is you've worked the whole year. It's the end of the year. And I think a lot of people just kind of want to reward themselves. The other thing is that we've got mass media marketing. It used to be just television. Now it's television, radio, internet. Every time you turn on, I don't know, you're playing a game, Candy Crush, somebody's selling you something. And so at this point, they're just trying to really approach your emotions and have you, you know, buy products through some kind of emotional behavior. And most of the time, it's just they want to reward themselves.
I'm right up there with the voice we heard of the woman who says she likes a massage. That's one that I could go for.
Again, we have to reframe it. If it's a massage because you need it because you're stressed out, because I know that the show can stress you out, then it's not an indulgence. It's a need.
Now, that seems like a really interesting way to justify things. Where's that tipping point where you go from indulgence to convincing yourself that you need something?
Ah, very good. That's an excellent question. And I will share with you, I go back, as long as you can pay for it, as long as you don't have to go into debt for it, as long as you don't have to put it on a credit card, or if you are going to put it on a credit card, that you can pay it off next month. And so, again, as long as you can afford it, there's no problem. But you have to live within your means, correct? So if you have the money to go get a massage, go get the massage. It's okay. The problem is I'm also seeing people who have a lot of money in the bank and a lot of emergency reserves, and they can indulge a little bit. It's okay to indulge. But again, I think that's the line right there. I don't want to see people basically, you know, putting their future on credit because that's what's going to hurt them in the long run.
Just quickly, give me your do's and don'ts for the season.
Set a spending limit. Do set a budget. Make a list of the people you're going to give to. Focus on the stores that you're going to end up shopping. Do go online first and do comparison shopping. Don't go into a store without a budget. Don't go into the store, obviously, just do the opposite of what I just said, without a list. Really sit down and think about how much you can spend. Do not accept credit cards. Every time you're sitting there and you're paying and you're going to a new store, they're offering you a credit card because they'll give you a 10% discount. Don't take those credit cards. Unless you're going to do all their shopping there and you know that you can pay that credit card off next month, don't accept the new credit card.
We are right up on the holidays now. What if, you know, the horse is out of the barn door? You've overindulged, perhaps. What's a strategy for walking yourself back?
If you've already spent the money, then what you want to do now is incorporate your debt into your New Year's resolutions. That's all we can do. Sit down, make a list of the money you've spent, the interest rate you're going to be paying on those credit cards, and start paying those suckers down. And make it a goal that we're going to get these things paid off within the next couple of months.
And actually do it as opposed to, I'm going to go to the gym 5 times a week?
Absolutely.
Thank
Why,
you,
Lizzie,
Lewis.
You're not, you, when you make those resolutions, you don't keep them?
I overshoot on occasion.
Okay.
Lewis Barajas is a certified financial planner. Thank you so much, Lewis.
Always a pleasure, Lizzie.
Next week, we're focusing on the new year and specifically trying to get a new job. How are you trying to get an employer's attention in 2015? We want to hear your stories. Tell us by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. This week, we're talking about indulgence, including this one, which isn't legal unless you live in Colorado or Washington, marijuana. I want you to think about how you picture marijuana's brand. Is it strictly college stoners and Cheech and Chong? Because believe it or not, there is an entire business devoted to rebranding pot, which, after all, is a commodity bringing in millions of dollars in tax revenue in the states where it's legal. Olivia Mannix is the co-founder of the marijuana marketing company Cannabrand, which works with marijuana businesses in Colorado. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to know what you think marijuana's brand is right now.
It's still largely stigmatized. There's still a lot of misinformation out there where people don't really understand the value of the plant in terms of medical and recreational purposes. What we're trying to do is help its brand and its image by running campaigns and helping our clients with their brands and how they want marijuana, or we say cannabis, to be portrayed by the public.
You use the word cannabis, marijuana, but you're not using, you know, pot, weed, as I think my mother would say, grass, any of of those terms. I'm guessing that's intentional.
Yes. We try to stray away from pot, weed, grass, because I personally feel that those names have negative connotations. Just using cannabis to describe the product is another step towards rebranding and also debunking myths and stigmas associated with the plant.
When you think about debunking the stigmas that you call them, how much of that do you think is about widespread acceptance or legality, and how much of that is about perception?
Ooh, that's hard to say. I definitely think they're both issues. So in terms of legality and perception, I think they actually go hand in hand. Because if we were to change the perception of what people think cannabis is, that will influence policymakers. So I think in order to legalize cannabis federally in the next few years, we'll really need to change the perception of what people think cannabis is, and ideally just take away all of the old school propaganda that we were fed.
I imagine there are going to be people listening to this interview who say, you've got to be kidding me. An advertising agency built around marketing pot? They're going to think that seems insane.
Yeah, I mean, it might sound insane, but this is an industry, this is a marketplace, and every industry needs to have some type of branding and marketing and advertising associated with it. And yes, one might think that marijuana, cannabis sells itself and it doesn't need to be marketed, but now that this is a legal industry, it's a competitive marketplace, and companies need to differentiate themselves.
So who's the customer you're trying to reach right now?
We're reaching lots of different customers because we have different types of clients who either market to the age range of 21 to 35, to the boomers. So it really depends on what the product is that we're selling, and it's pretty much opening up the plant to a wider demographic.
Well, let's say you were going to market to me. I'm a 39-year-old public radio host. You know, I work really hard. I don't have a ton of time. How do you convince me, yeah, one of these products is for you?
We would figure out kind of what your lifestyle, your trends are. Say you enjoy having a glass of wine at night. Maybe you'd like to try a low dose of an edible or a vape pen and see how that would make you feel. Because there are a lot of positive aspects to marijuana. And for instance, like, you won't have a hangover. There's definitely a lot of health benefits associated with consuming cannabis instead of drinking or using cannabis to relax or using cannabis to be creative.
There's been a backlash too, though. You know, people who have gone to Colorado or Washington and maybe consumed products, gotten very high, and seem to not know what they're doing. Is there a niche in that space for your messaging to reach?
We are always on top of the latest laws and regulations. I think the biggest gap is education and people not knowing how much they should be consuming, where they should be consuming. So that's something that we're really trying to promote, because a lot of people would eat an edible, not feel anything, and then eat more, and then later on feel the effects too much.
Does some of this have to do with physical space? I mean, some of these dispensaries can seem a little creepy, a little grungy, and maybe aren't attractive to the larger market, and certainly the kind of sort of upscale professionals that, you know, some of your brands are targeted toward.
There actually are a lot of beautiful dispensaries in the Denver and Colorado area that have really been able to change their interior design, and some of them look like Mac stores, some of them just have beautiful woodwork, and a lot of the other dispensaries are sort of evolving their brands and making their space more comfortable for their target market.
You got in some trouble when the New York Times did a story looking at rebranding of marijuana, and you said, we're weeding out the stoners, which is sort of a tongue-in-cheek quote. But it raised some real tension between a lot of activists who felt like they'd pushed for legalization for a long time, and then a lot of these new businesses. How did you navigate that?
So that quote was miscommunicated on what we were trying to say. What we were trying to say was that we're trying to change the image of the industry in terms of marketing and advertising and just giving it a cleaner and a better look, because honestly, the industry has not been in the best light. So we're not weeding out the stoners per se. It's trying to change the image of the industry.
What's the target? Can you give me an example of an industry right now that you think in 5 years you would like to see cannabis emulate?
Definitely the liquor industry, just in terms of how it's regulated that you can market and advertise with liquor. I really would like to see there be more leniency so that marketers and advertisers can do their job for the cannabis industry.
Olivia Mannix is the co-founder of CannaBrand. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finally, speaking of indulgence, this is the time of year that holiday-themed movies, even ones you've seen dozens of times before, can feel like they're on an endless loop on TV. For author Erin Mallory Long, The Muppet Christmas Carol is one story she watched, indulged in, maybe was obsessed with, time and again. I'll let Long explain.
My brother and I would watch it. We watched it over and over and over. We would probably even watch it twice in one day. So it's one of those things that I knew so well, but it makes it so I can't look at Michael Caine without thinking that he's Ebenezer Scrooge. And I want like Rizzo the Rat to just be like sitting around just narrating everything for me. It affects your life in ways that you can't even really comprehend at the time. Bob Cratchit is Kermit the Frog in my mind. It's a story that obviously is human-based, and just because this is my introduction to it, I have blinders on to everything else. My first relationships in high school were completely based around the idea that I was Joey Potter from Dawson's Creek. And I found myself getting into a fight with my boyfriend at the time. And I was like, no, see, I'm Joey and you're Pacey. And he didn't watch the show and didn't understand what correlation I was making or how our relationship could possibly be like this teen drama. So it gets me in trouble a lot. If I try to quote The Simpsons or Friends and like someone doesn't get the joke or get the reference, I get confused. Like, oh, you haven't watched this 47,000 times? Like, let me explain to you. Because in my head, I'm doing such a good job at conveying the joke and doing an impression that you should be able to read that I'm doing Chandler, you know? So it's kind of like, it's sort of, I think it's the biggest drawback on my friendships, honestly. I definitely only love or hate things. You know, the movie Crash winning Best Picture, and I'm like livid for 10 years about it. Ross and Rachel on Friends being on a break, like, ruined everyone's lives. You know, some people spend money on designer shoes, and I spend money, like, searching Etsy for, like, a Simpsons toy from 1989. I saw Lisa Kudrow. She was on a show I was working on. I luckily didn't have to interact with her directly, but I saw her walk past a doorway, and I just stared at her like a psycho. And I did the same thing to Tina Fey. I saw her once, and we locked eyes, and she looked at me, and I looked at her, and she smiled, and I died inside. I think for the most part, I want them to stay as their characters and as who they are in my mind. My goal is always to get to the point where something that I love is ingrained in me and I know everything about it. That's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Jody Avergan and Vanessa Smith. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Ravi Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
Next week, we'll talk about jobs, renewal, and the new year. Thanks for listening. This is APM.